The Masterclass podcast is made on the unceded land of the Wurundjeri, Woiwurrung and Bunurong people. We recognise First Nations people as the original owners and custodians of the lands and waterways across the Australian continent. We pay our respects to elders past and present. Always was, always will be Aboriginal land.
It's about fairness in the search for the truth and fairness in publishing our stories. Journalism is a profession of infinite possibility. You just need to apply yourself and be determined and be ethical and be thorough.
So you studied journalism at university. Did you ever imagine that you would one day win 16 Walkleys and do all these investigations?
I've exceeded my wildest goals and expectations. But I think I did know one thing as a student, that I'd be conscientious and work extremely hard and try to keep my sense of ethics at all times. I'm Nick McKenzie, investigative journalist with The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald. And today I'm going to give you a masterclass in journalism ethics and defamation.
Hello and welcome to season 3 of the Masterclass podcast. I'm Louisa Lim and I teach audio journalism and podcasting at the University of Melbourne. Each week, we're speaking to a master of journalism to talk about one aspect of their work. Today, we're talking to Nick McKenzie, an investigative journalist with The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald, who's won 16 Walkley Awards. Nick, your work is all about investigative journalism, and you're doing these incredibly complicated investigations. But when we talk about journalism ethics, what does that mean to you?
I guess at its heart, it's about fairness in the search for the truth and fairness in publishing our stories. So conducting yourself with absolute ethics, morality, you can't cut corners or, like, for instance, checkbook journalism. Paying for an interview is a tainted or usually a tainted process. When you engage with your, say, confidential sources, standing by your pledge to look after them, to keep them confidential, etc., but also in the actual publication of what you do, striving to be fair and balanced. And what does all that mean? It means that you arrive as close to the truth as you possibly can, knowing the search for truth is an imprecise science.
So the Journalism Union, the MEAA, has got this code of ethics. How important has that been for you during your career?
I think it's a statement of the obvious, but it's an important statement. And obvious things are sometimes important to remind ourselves of. So really, the code of ethics simply expands that notion of how to conduct oneself fairly. So, for instance, you identify yourself as a journalist, so you don't pretend to be somebody else. Where possible, you use sources on the record. So you say to an audience, I'm quoting someone, but this is their name and their position. That's important because if someone's off the record, we don't know their name and position, then they might be pushing a vested interest that's not clear. By knowing who they are, we can understand, oh, this is why they're saying this, and take that into account as we weigh, as a reader, a story. So the code of ethics is just a really useful, it's a dot point guide as to what it is to be fair, thorough, and just as a journalist.
So you talk about anonymity, and different news organisations really have different guidelines as to whether they allow anonymous sources. When do you consider allowing your sources to remain anonymous?
You avoid anonymous sources as much as you can because what they're saying is not necessarily the whole story. Who they are and where they sit in the story, what their vested interest is, may well be a really important part of the story that an audience member deserves to know. But for some things, like if you're reporting on, say, national security, and you're talking to somebody in a national security agency, a law enforcement agency, an intelligence agency, something like that, then if they are revealed as a source, they'll lose their job or they might be charged for leaking information. So in those circumstances, if those sources are helping you reveal or explain something important, then very carefully they can be used. But it really falls on the journalist to make sure the source and what they're giving you is stress tested as much as possible. You don't allow somebody who's anonymous to make something up, or you question them on what they're saying, and you use what they're saying to help you arrive, and ultimately your reader or listener, to arrive at the truth. And unfortunately, I think that's not happening enough. Anonymous sources can be used cheaply and quickly to inform a story without enough stress testing and without enough initial application by the journalist in respect to the question, can I get this person on the record? Can I push them to go on the record? As uncomfortable as that conversation might be, I really should have it many times, if not every time, because someone on the record is much more powerful than someone off.
So you mentioned stress testing and that claims need to be stress tested. What do you mean by that?
Well, ultimately, just because someone says it is so does not mean it is so. Just because it's written in a document or in a text message or in a court file does not mean it to be so. So we look to find ways of corroborating allegations or information to arrive at some form of the truth. And I say some form of the truth is ultimately, or can ultimately be elusive. So all we can do is apply as much thoroughness through our investigations, which is, you know, what, talking to as many people who might know something as possible, searching as many open source avenues about something as possible, as many closed source, so confidential information that you might be leaked from somebody in government as possible, but doing all these tasks to test that allegation. Is it true or is it not? Where is there going to be information that might actually raise the question that this is false? And I need to go and get that information. So one thing that we guard against when we're going through this process is confirmation bias. We may wish for something to be true. So we subconsciously even block out avenues of inquiry, which may show that something is in fact not true. So it's really important to keep that open mind, to go down those other avenues. You end up with a more complicated story, but a richer story. That's what stress testing is.
Now, one really major principle in journalism is to try, as you've talked about, to protect your sources. But you've done a lot of work with whistleblowers. When these whistleblowers come forward, it often has massive impacts on them. How do you weigh up the benefit of the story as opposed to the risk to your interviewees?
Well, you must weigh up the public interest benefit of doing something with the impact on a person who might be involved in the story as a storyteller or whistleblower. And often the impact can be tremendous. They can feel very cleansed. It can be cathartic. They can feel a sense of purpose and mission by telling the public something they deserve to know. They can put their demons to rest by exposing or apologizing for something. They can expose wrongdoing, a corrupt boss. And that can all be a really healing and worthwhile thing as an individual as they help to serve the public interest. Of course, they can also be crunched. They can be sued. They can be accused of making things up. And even when they haven't, they can face online trolls and the rest of it. So there can be really negative repercussions. And ultimately, you say to somebody, this is what we have to do to manage this. The first thing we do is to tell you what the blowback might look like and be open and honest about it. And then you can decide whether you want to keep going. But right now, I'm working on a story where I think there is a whistleblower who, if their name was to be made public, they might face some sort of blowback. So my suggestion to them is to weigh that up, and then do they ask themselves the question, do I reveal my name and tell my story openly, or do I stay behind the scenes as an off-the-record source? And of course, if they do that, I say to them, well, your story won't have as much power. People will take it rightly with a grain of salt because they don't know who you are. You're in the shadows. But it might be ultimately a better thing to do. The story's weakened, but your individual privacy and the impact on you is lessened. So let's pursue that course. But you need to have that honest, open chat, remembering that famous line, the journalist is always using somebody. We are using people, but as long as we're open about the fact that we're using them to serve the public interest, and this is the impact on them, and this is how journalism works, it should be justifiable. In fact, it should be a noble pursuit.
So another risk for journalists, and one that you've come up against a lot of times during your career, is the risk of being sued for defamation. That's where someone can take legal action if they feel their reputation has been damaged. What's the very basic sort of checklist of things that journalists should do to reduce the risk of being sued for defamation?
Well, I think acting in adherence with the code of ethics helps, because if you conduct yourself properly and thoroughly in the search of a truth that aids public knowledge and is in the public interest, then you're already creating a potential defense for a lawsuit, being reasonableness, qualified privilege as a journalist that you, even if you can't prove what you've written to a court standard, you've conducted yourself in such a way as to have a court find that what you did was acceptable, reasonable in the circumstances and in the public benefit. That defense is very hard to stand up. So the other thing you must do as a journalist, of course, is to make sure what you write is indeed true, but not just true, but provable as true. So there's a great difference between something being true and your ability to prove it in a civil defamation court. because you need to marshal admissible evidence in a court, evidence that you might have it for an article which is entirely admissible, but you can't get it into admissible form in a court. And let's say you have a source on the record who's in the Middle East and they give you an interview, but they can't come to Australia because someone is going to harm them if they come here. Well, you've got that interview, they're on the record, you publish it, but unless they're in court as a witness and there's no video link, we can't get them to court, then it's very hard to get their evidence in an admissible way to back you up. So an example of the challenges that you might face in ascertaining the truth as a reporter and reporting it and then going to try to defend that story if you are sued. The other thing you must look for as a journalist is, well, I'm writing ABC, but I actually might be saying D. And by that I mean that there can be imputations or not clear or hidden meanings that linger in your text or your broadcast, which you never intended to actually communicate, but which someone might argue nevertheless arise. And unfortunately, Australian courts are very quick to find, well, these imputations, these hidden meanings are there. And therefore, even if a journalist didn't mean to communicate these things and didn't say them in the piece, in fact, might have said things quite to the contrary, I will still say those meanings could have arisen for an audience member. And therefore, you end up defending the truth of something that you never intended to say. So you must guard against that in your reporting as well. And that involves putting a whole series of qualifiers. It's become a bit of a problem in Australia, though, because now journalists, if you read many stories, difficult investigative stories, there's so many qualifiers in stories almost to make them often unreadable, to guard against that problem with the unexpected imputation. I didn't mean to say this, but the judge might say I've said it anyhow. How do I guard against that? Well, I'll put in the story, we're not suggesting this or that. And it becomes pretty dense and pretty difficult for a writer and a reader. But nevertheless, the thing you're guarding against. So going back to those things, acting ethically, properly in your journey as a journalist, arriving at the truth, not just a truth in a story, but an admissible truth in court, and guarding against hidden or unintended meanings to make sure that you're not left defending the truth of those meanings in the court down the track.
So students often think that if they use the word allegedly in a story, that will protect them. Is that the case?
No, it's not the case. I mean, it's a qualifier to a degree. You're saying it's an allegation, it's not proven. But ultimately, you need to put a lot more sort of contextual qualifiers around something like that, depending on the circumstances, of course, to guard against defamation. Yeah, if you say someone's facing an allegation of a very serious crime, let's call it treason, it would be said that the imputation, the meaning might arise that they are actually treasonous. And you say, well, I said it allegedly, and the judge might say, well, even though that word's there, an audience member could still leap to the conclusion that they have committed treason. And so you've got to be a quick and easy word to use, but it won't solve the problem.
And how important is the right of reply, allowing the person who you're making the allegations against a chance to refute them or to comment on them?
It's really, of course, important. It's going back again to that very first question. It's about fairness. And if you're making or intend to research and write serious allegations about somebody, you should be able to interview them, sit down with them, talk to them on the phone, send them questions about what the allegations are so they can respond in kind. The problem is very savvy media players like politicians will simply spin their way out of things. The practice in journalism and broadcast journalism is you never tell somebody, if you can avoid it, what you're going to ask them. Because people always ask, can you send me the questions? Well, that allows them to sit down with their lawyers, plan their responses, and that's not going to help the search for the truth. You say to somebody, no, I don't intend to tell you what I'm going to ask you, but you're a public person, you're a politician, there's a public interest in the story. I'd like you simply to answer the questions that I put to you. The point being, you must put the questions to them. Unfortunately, lots of journalism happens where someone leaves it to 5 o'clock, you know, an hour before deadline, to ask the accused what they think of the allegation. And they may not be able to get onto the accused, or the email bounces. The story runs anyhow, and it's missing something vital, which is that response. Because that response can also change the entire tenor of a story. Someone might say, yes, well, it may look like this, but actually read this information, and you end up realizing the accused is not what you thought that they were. So you know, the search for the truth really requires us to speak to the subject of a story, speak to the subject of allegations, and due process, so being fair, requires the same thing.
How important is it to keep your interviews and keep good records of your conversations?
You've got to keep the critical records, if anything, because they'll help you remember what someone's told you. And when that someone says, I didn't say that in the interview, you say, well, I'll play it back. Thank you very much. But there's also a danger, like I'm very careful about what confidential sources tell me and how I write that down and record that, because I'm very keen to not have them exposed if I'm raided or if I'm sued and I have to forced to hand things over. So I might keep things, I've got some sources communicate with me on a messaging application and the messages delete after a week or a day or a few hours. So when you're actually in the real field of journalism, you must be really careful to retain information that's important, but manage confidential source information really delicately as well.
In some cases, in your reporting, you've done things that could be seen to cross certain boundaries. And I'm thinking in particular about the use of secret recordings in your 2020 story on branch stacking in the Victorian Labour Party. I think we have a clip of you introducing that 60 Minutes episode.
Good evening and welcome to a special edition of 60 Minutes. I'm Nick McKenzie. This is a story which exposes one of the Labour Party's faceless men, Adam Somurek. He's a Victorian cabinet minister on Labour's national executive and a factional kingpin who's consumed by the power he's amassed through blatant corruption. Now, normally we'd never know what goes on in the back rooms of Australian politics, but we've obtained secret audio and video recordings that catch out the real Adam Somurek. The evidence is unequivocal. You'll be hearing his actual voice.
When you engage in, I guess, unusual methods or atypical methods, you've got to be really careful about what it is that you're doing and to make sure that it's lawful and ethical. Yeah, in the case you describe, it was entirely lawful and ethical because this lawful gaining of information was exposing alleged corruption, the alleged abuse of power by somebody in politics. And I can't go into the circumstances of how those listening devices, if you wish to call them that, were who installed them, whether it was whistleblowers or somebody else. I can never get into that because that may reveal sources. But I can tell you that it was done ethically and lawfully and absolutely in aid of the public interest. And we know this because those same recordings were used by the Independent Broad-Based Anti-Corruption Commission of Victoria to expose further wrongdoing and corruption. So that agency deemed the recordings lawfully made and appropriate to use and air themselves. But it is unusual to get information that way or to engage in what's known crudely as a sting. There's some very, very famous examples, especially from the United Kingdom, where journalists know that there's a corrupt lobbyist who's offering, for instance, access to politicians in return for kickbacks or payments. But the only way to prove that is to send someone, a reporter, in, and this has happened in the UK, pretending to be a client of that lobbyist and asking for a service and seeing what happens. Now, under Australia's code of ethics, that could not happen, or it certainly test those kind of ethics because you're meant to introduce yourself as a reporter, if you are a reporter. So, I mean, there are times where the ethics will come into conflict with the process, but that's when you've got to go on a case-by-case basis. Is the process ethical? Is it lawful? And is it appropriate? And why am I doing this? Is it to embarrass somebody, invade someone's privacy, or is it to expose corruption that the public deserve to know about? And those are the questions that you must be asking as you look to engage with different means to gather information.
So you studied journalism at university, didn't you? I mean, at that time, did you ever imagine that you would one day win 16 Walkleys and do all these investigations?
A student doesn't imagine themselves even 2 years from the day that they are a student, let alone imagining a full career. And my career has been far more eventful and rewarding and stressful, I must say, than I ever thought possible. I've exceeded my wildest goals and expectations. But I think I did know one thing as a student, that I'd be conscientious and work extremely hard and try to keep my sense of ethics at all time, which has been really important, all those things, to help me keep working as a journalist and to do really, really interesting and hopefully meaningful work at times. But the great thing about being a student journalist and transitioning into full-time journalism is the youngest journalist in a newsroom can break the biggest story of the week or the year. Journalism is a profession of infinite possibility. You just need to apply yourself and be determined and be ethical and be thorough and be guided by the public interest. And you can find the most critical information and help the public learn what they should, whether you're 60 years old or 20 years old. And that's why it's an exciting profession.
Do you have a particular story that posed a sort of particularly hard ethical quandary for you, or where you feel like you may have made the wrong decision?
Yeah, there's definitely been ethical junctures, quandaries at all, but often. And, you know, I tend to seek advice from people. Should I go down this path? How do I handle this person? A lot of it's to do with source management and managing people that you might interview. Some of it's to do with how one gets information. Should I get this classified document? Should I actually retain it, or should I just read it? Because if I hold it, I might be committing an offence, or more of an offence than if I simply allow someone to read it to me. All these ethical questions: how we gain information, by what means, what is the information itself? Journalism's often coming in conflict with the law. I need people to show me things that are classified or secret and maybe break the law in doing so. And yet that information's crucial for the public to make sure our institutions are being held to account or our politicians are being held to account. But that creates an ethical dilemma. Do I risk someone breaking the law and becoming an accessory to that in the aid of public interest journalism? When you do a story, you look back and go, I wish I'd done that. I wish I'd looked under that stone. I wish I had asked that extra question. I wish I'd looked at that extra database. And I've had some high profile failings. I thought I was thorough at the time, but in hindsight, I realized I wasn't as thorough as I could be. And you just learn as you go. I'm still 21 years in. I'm still learning every day.
From 21 years of experience, what are your two top tips for students in thinking about journalism ethics?
That idea of fairness, you know, making that a central part of who you are as a journalist. And that will inform every step you take as a reporter, be it writing a story, telling a story, interviewing a source, gathering information. And fairness encompasses lots of things: honesty and integrity and a dedication to the truth. So being fair, I mean, the other critical thing I think is, I mean, you've got to be relentlessly determined as a reporter. Now, the biggest tool any reporter can have is determination. You need to be hardworking and strive to the truth. And, you know, sometimes do things that might be uncomfortable or difficult or stressful, but so fair and determined. And if you're really fair and you're really determined, you'll succeed as a journalist.
Thank you. And I think you have a task for our students.
Pick an investigative story or a tricky story, like a hard-hitting story, and look at the anonymous sources and identify where information is not properly sourced. And where it is sourced, go check the source yourself. Like if there's a data leak or there's a court file, where you can, go to the original source yourself and say, has the journalist actually reflected that source appropriately? And in doing that, you'll be able to unpick how the story is sort of woven together and the ethical issues that might be at play. So is the journalist relying too much on an anonymous source and they might have a vested interest or a motive that's not clear on the story? Or has the journalist adequately or not fairly or fairly used a court document or a source of data to make a point in this story? Is this journalist letting their own personal bias drip through the story? Is this more opinion than fact? A really worthwhile exercise to do with any story, really, because it will aid you in your own journalism research and writing.
That was Nick McKenzie, an investigative journalist with The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald. The Masterclass is produced by Dylan Bird and myself. It's edited by Dylan Bird. Sound design and post-production by John Chia. The original concept is by Anders Furs. The theme tune is by Susie Wilkins. It was partially funded by the GEM Scott Trust and is brought to you from the Centre for Advancing Journalism at the University of Melbourne.